The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Not only have we been able to do investigation and attribution, we've been able to do it with sufficient confidence to make it public, and in many instances to bring criminal cases, which have the highest burden of proof in our system, beyond that we're confident that we can prove something beyond a reasonable doubt. Look at what we've done in a relatively short period of time of trying this new approach. We brought charges against five members of the People's Liberation Army Unit 61398. We've brought charges against the Syrian Electronic Army. We've caught members who, on behalf of the Islamic State in the Levant, stole personal identifiable information in order to pass it to terrorists so they could cull through it to figure out who the government employees were so they could put a call out to kill them. We've shown across this range of actors we can figure out who did it with such specificity that by name, in most of those instances, we can charge them.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 2nd, 2016. John Carlin, Assistant Attorney General for National Security, has a new law review article out. It's entitled Detect, Disrupt, Deter, a Whole of Government Approach to National Security Cyber Threats. It was published recently in the Harvard National Security Journal. In it, Carlin argues that the government is employing a new strategy for cybersecurity, one based on attribution and a diverse array of punitive tools for cyber bad actors. I caught up with Carlin this week at the Justice Department to discuss the article, the department's recent successes in the national security cyber arena, and whether they are really having an effect. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 177, John Carlin Uses All the Tools.
I want to start with two terms that you use very liberally in this piece. One is whole of government, and the other is all tools. When you say a whole of government approach, and you refer to that as a change, it sort of implies that before we adopted a whole of government approach, we were working with a part of government approach. And before we started using all the tools, we were only using some of the tools. And I'm interested, I read the article with sort of this, well, when was the part when we had a part of government and some tools approach? You're definitely describing a change here, and I'm trying to figure out when the change took place and what came before the whole of government, all tools approach that you're describing here.
Well, maybe I'll start with some personal examples. When I was a prosecutor prosecuting computer hacking intellectual property cases in the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C., I worked with a great squad at the FBI. And what we worked on day in, day out, were criminal hacking cases. There was another squad actually located down the hall from where we would often work together, who were behind a literal locked door. They were in a secure, compartmented facility working behind that locked door. The whole time, this is around 06, 07, I was working on these criminal cases, I never went onto the other side of that door. And sometimes one of the agents on the squad that I was working with would switch and get transferred to that squad. I never really saw them again. They just were doing whatever they did behind that locked door. When I came over to FBI and I realized what it was. What they were doing was the intelligence side of the house. They were focused on threats like nation states. And when I was doing the criminal work, it's not like I didn't have enough to do. There was plenty of computer hacking cases done by criminal groups, and there still are. But what I wasn't looking at was what was going on the intelligence side of the house. When I was at FBI, we transformed and got much better, I think, at compiling that intelligence picture that was happening behind the closed door. But it really wasn't until around end of 2012 when we launched this new program, the National Security Cyber Specialist Program, trained people in U.S. attorneys' offices all across the country, and that the FBI similarly issued a directive that said, now that these folks are specially trained, let's do what we have done with terrorism cases. Let's make sure these folks are looking at what's on the intelligence side of the house. So you meet regularly with them, share that intelligence side, and look together to see, are there disruption opportunities?
Walk me through, for those who haven't read it yet, the basic argument of this article. You start out with an account of the threat, which will be familiar to a lot of the readers of the, you know, readers of Lawfare over any period of time, or people who follow cybersecurity issues. So you got these threats. What's the argument that you're making here about them?
That in order to confront this new environment of threat, in part what we need to do is apply some of the lessons that we learned when confronting the terrorism threat. And one of those was, we can't be driven by our particular statutory tool. We can't only look to do criminal prosecutions because we're criminal prosecutors. Instead, we need to be driven by what the intelligence is showing the threat to be, and then use whatever legally available tool there is to disrupt the threat. So that may mean bringing criminal prosecutions in a space we'd never brought criminal prosecutions before, charging nation-state actors like the five members of the People's Liberation Army. It may mean going public with information when we know, for instance, the North Koreans attacked Sony. It may mean using sanctions, as we did against North Korea. It may mean using the Commerce Department's authorities to designate certain entities as ones to whom you can't export goods, like we did with the company affiliated with Su Bin, the hacker who had attacked into Boeing. But at base, it means that we're working together, looking across the intelligence, and as lawyers, we're picking the legal tool that we think will have the maximum effect to disrupt the threat.
So one of the things is, when you say as lawyers, not everybody involved in the list of people that actors you've just described are lawyers. What you've described is, when you say whole of government, is, you know, you've described the presidency, really, right? For everything from Commerce Department authorities to Treasury Department authorities to your ability to bring a criminal case. So one of the things that I was wondering when I read this is, what is the coordinating mechanism for this whole of government? I mean, is it ultimately NSC and the president, or is there some lower level, here's the degree of attribution we've managed, here are our options, let's jointly figure out what to do. When you're coordinating this many tools, who's, to use George W. Bush's term, who's the decider?
Well, let me take a step back too in terms of the articles. One thing I thought was important for us to lay out, just in having conversations like the ones we've had over the years and with outside groups, is to make a case that may seem simple, but when it comes to confronting cyber intrusions, and by that I mean attacks that can destroy data, intrusions that steal information for commercial benefit, steal it for the benefit of a strategic benefit, if you're going to disrupt them at the base, you need to be able to do investigation and attribution. So figure out who did it. And for a period of time, because this was so new, there may be some who thought, well, you just can't figure that out when it comes to things that are cyber-enabled. And I think what we've shown is you can. It's hard, but you can figure it out.
Okay, so let me push you on that, because I agree, like, 5 years ago, everybody kind of agreed attribution really difficult in this space, and you often heard the term impossible associated with attribution. Now you hear from you, from a lot of the people in the private sector, actually we're pretty gotten pretty good at attribution. And so I'm interested in how big the delta is there. The average cyber intrusion that gets reported to you guys that you investigate, are you guys in a position to attribute it? I mean, not publicly attribute it, but at the end of your investigation, do you know who's responsible?
Yeah, remember, in my what I've received, National Security Division, we focus on nation state actors and terrorist groups. And what you've seen is not only have we been able to do investigation and attribution, we've been able to do it with sufficient confidence to make it public, and in many instances to bring criminal cases, which have the highest burden of proof in our system, beyond that we're confident that we could prove something beyond a reasonable doubt. And look at what we've done in a relatively short period of time of trying this new approach. We brought charges against five members of the People's Liberation Army Unit 61398 for their conduct in stealing information for economic benefit from industries ranging from nuclear to solar to steel. We've brought charges against the Syrian Electronic Army, who had done mischief, causing attacks like feigning that there had been an attack on the White House that caused the stock market to lose enormous amount of value for a short period of time. We've caught members who, on behalf of the Islamic State in the Levant, stole personal identifiable information in order to pass it to terrorists so they could cull through it to figure out who the government employees were so they could put a call out to kill them. In one instance, we caught an individual who recently pled guilty for being in a conspiracy with others in China to hack into Boeing to steal fighter jet design. So whether it's, and we've publicly named and laid out the reasoning on North Korean actors. So ranging from bad actors doing bad things from North Korea to China to the Syrian Electronic Army to Iran in the case of their DDoS attacks against the financial institution to terrorist groups like the Islamic State and the Levant. We've shown across this range of actors, we can figure out who did it with such specificity that by name, in most of those instances, we can charge them.
But that's a slightly different question than the one I asked. So the question you just answered is, are you sometimes able to attribute things with sufficient specificity and certainty to say something in public or to even bring an indictment? But my question is, in the average case that you care about, do you get, you obviously don't get in the average point to the point that you want to bring an indictment necessarily or you want to say something public. But I'm trying to get to how frequently you can actually do an attribution to the level of your own satisfaction, to the level of whatever the law may require for whatever action you're going to take. Are we living in a world in which attribution is basically a norm that's achievable now? Or are we still living in a world in which attribution, yes, sometimes possible, but basically really difficult?
I think it's difficult, but the intelligence community, working with law enforcement, working with the private sector, has proven to be very good at doing attribution and figuring out whether it's nation state actors or terrorist groups attempting to develop means, who's doing what. In order to do that, though, particularly when you try to get into the why did they took, what they took, when they took it, one area where we need to improve is in terms of having conversations and information sharing with the private sector. And that's an area that's much better than it was, say, 10, 12 years ago when I was doing it, but one that could improve and needs to improve if we're going to continue our efforts to confront this threat.
So Congress passed a big law to facilitate that last year. How much has CISA changed things, and what more, other than the fact that we need more of it, what more needs to happen in order to have the degree of information transfer that would sort of take it to a different level?
So CISA, the Cyber Information Sharing Act, is still relatively new. And one thing we're doing is doing concerted outreach both at the Department of Justice, Department of Homeland Security, to ask companies, how's it going? Is this enabling you to share information in the way they envision, not just with us, but with each other? We also, as a country, are getting more developed in the way that we talk about these issues. But for a period of time, it was very much blame the victim, right? So there's a shaming that would occur. And I think accordingly, companies would be hesitant to tell anyone, including government, what had happened to them, for fear that because they had been intruded upon, people would blame them for the activity. And so unlike almost every other area of crime that I've worked on, where the natural thing is when you've been the victim of a crime, and certainly if you've been attacked, it seems like by another nation state, you would come in to the government, tell them what happened, and ask for their help. Cyber, for a period of time, people didn't. And we're starting to see that happen now, but I think that needs to continue to evolve.
So there's a, as you know, a skeptic community with regard to the thesis that, or the constituent parts of the thesis that you've laid out here. And the skepticism runs like this. Yeah, you can investigate and attribute a small fraction of the cases. In those cases, you can issue an indictment, but you can't get custody more often than not of the individuals you've indicted. And so you have a campaign that amounts more to naming and shaming than real functioning law enforcement. And you have a no evidence that the result of this is a diminution of these sort of attacks. Now, there, as you know, acknowledged that there is that last point is controversial, and there's some reason to think that the Chinese government may have moderated its behavior in response to some of this. How do you evaluate it now? How should we understand the effects of these indictments and these public statements? And prospectively, what should I be looking for as evidence that this project is or isn't working?
Well, there's a lot.
There's a lot of subparts of that question.
So let me break it into different parts in terms of response. One, in the relatively short period of time since we made the decision to take what had formerly only been in the shadows, only been in the intelligence land, work to see what we could do and say publicly. So do the investigation attribution to figure out who did it, not be afraid to say it publicly, and work to impose consequences. Here's what I think you've seen. We brought the indictment against the five members of the People's Liberation Army. You then had the attack on Sony, and you saw us in short order there in less than 28 days figure out who did it and do the unprecedented step of saying it was North Korea and imposing sanctions. Then you saw the passing of an executive order which would allow for the imposition on sanctions, not just on those who steal information or work to destroy information, but those who benefit, the companies or individuals who benefit from the stolen information. That led up to an unprecedented event where you had a high-level delegation come over from China representing President Xi at the last moment before a summit, work out the so-called five-point agreement, and agree for the first time as one of the norms. So one of the laws for the world we want to live in going forward, that a norm would be we shouldn't use our government apparatus to steal information essentially for private profit. That led to the G20 adopting that as one of its norms for the first time. And look, the president and others have said, in some respects, cyberspace is the Wild West. Right now, if we want to bring in a rule of law, if we want the sheriff in town, then one of the first things we have to do is create norms. What are the laws of the land? Now, getting to the second part of your question is, how do you enforce those norms? Because the prosecutors, law enforcement, we'd be out of business if passing the law meant the problem was solved. So we have that norm on the book. Can you impose real consequences? What I would argue, and we do, that leaving the criminal justice system off the table was a mistake. And I'm not sure anyone even deliberately planned to do that. But think of it for a second as you had intrusions occurring every day across the country into companies, small, big, and medium, where noisily you had Chinese People's Liberation Army, Intel, stealing information for economic benefit. And we were just letting it go without treating as criminal what we would treat as criminal in any other context. And there's a concept in the law that many of your listeners will be familiar to you of the easement. If you let someone walk across your lawn long enough, they have the right to walk across your lawn. And international law, which is customary law, is quite similar to that same concept. So if we didn't bring a case, we were essentially going to create a norm that said this is okay. And it's not okay. Should not be an acceptable status quo. So we bring the case, and it's a giant no trespassing sign. Now we have this norm. We can, even just using the criminal justice system as one part of this whole government, you can find individuals and hold them accountable. Ardit Farizi, the individual who is hacking on behalf of the Islamic State in Levant, arrested in Malaysia, brought to the United States to face trial, pled guilty, and will be held accountable for his crimes in the Eastern District of Virginia. This next case is pending, and they have all the rights to the accused, so these are just allegations, but we've alleged that there was a member of the Syrian Electronic Army who was arrested pursuant to our court process by the Germans, extradited to the United States, facing charges. Su Bin, Chinese individual who in a conspiracy hacked into Boeing and other companies, arrested pursuant to our process in Canada, pled guilty in the Central District of California after waiving extradition, which he had fought for several years. Real people, real crimes in real jail cells facing consequences. And that's just the criminal system. We are just at the beginning, I think, of using other tools, as we have effectively for years when it comes to terrorists and those who would proliferate weapons of mass destruction, like using sanctions, like using commerce authorities, continuing to pound diplomatically. And, you know, depending on the scale of the attack and the actor when we're in an armed conflict, using military tools. So if the bottom line, I think, is this is a new vector by which we can be attacked, both in a military sense, but also as criminals. And in order to respond to it, we need to be creative. But as part of that has to be figuring out who did it, making it public, and deterring them from doing the conduct.
So what is the metric by which we should evaluate it? I mean, you know, you and Jack Goldsmith have had a bit of a back and forth in about to what extent these indictments have been effective. I'm interested sort of in the question of, you know, what the baseline is against which I should measure what degree of change. Yes, you can get your hands on some of them. No, you can't get your hands on all of them. How do I know if this policy is working?
And respect Professor Goldsmith, Jack Goldsmith, a great deal. And I think there's a fair amount of suggestion now, including a recent FireEye report saying they saw a notable decline in China-based groups' overall intrusion activity, that the activity has changed since we did the indictment. Yeah, you might say one idea.
Because Ugly Gorilla was really offended that you used his nom de guerre.
I think Director Comey is the one not referring specifically to Ugly Gorilla, but said they are like a gorilla ransacking around our house. They're so noisy in terms of what they were doing, and so we've seen a change now. If the declines, and they're actually, companies today don't need to worry as much as they did a year ago about having the second largest military in the world attacking them on a daily basis in order to steal trade negotiation tactics or internal business documents, that is a measure of success. It makes it safer for our companies here and builds us closer to the world that we all want to live in, where you can go about your business without having to worry about being attacked. But I think I don't want to declare success, though. We're just at the beginning. This is going to take a dedicated, long-term, whole-of-government, determined effort to raise the cost across the board to all the bad guys who are trying to do all the bad things they used to do in the brick-and-mortar world, and now they're trying to do it through cyber.
So from your point of view, the success in this area is a hypothesis at this stage, and this document is a strategy, not a "this has been our policy and we're winning" statement. Is that fair?
I'll leave it, I guess, to others to. I think there were some who would say certain actions that we took changed behavior in a positive way. But from my point of view, I'll leave that to others. I would just say a status quo where when you're a terrorist or a nation state, if you attack us through cyber means or steal through cyber means, we're not going to do anything. We're not going to figure out who you are, and we're not going to cause any pain to the adversary, that's a mistake. And we're at the beginning of a new approach that says, no, we can figure out who you are, and we will impose consequences.
So you analogized this whole thing to the shift after 9/11 in the terrorism space. And you've also described, I'm coming back here to my question about the coordinating mechanism. You've also described, a set of tools and a set of authorities that do not all reside within the Department of Justice, let alone within NSD. One of the process implications for that is that, after 9/11, the president became the chief counterterrorism officer of the United States, and he had to, part of the job of the presidency became coordinating the whole of government response to terrorism. And so if I take your argument at face value, it suggests that cyber is going to be a much, much bigger part of the essential work of the presidency than we've traditionally thought of it. So I want to come back to that. Who's the person with the toolbox when you talk about the all tools approach? Because it's not all the tools are in your reservoir.
Oh, I think that's
to mix a metaphor.
Just a bit, but I think it's exactly right. And so if you look at where one model that we've done with terrorism that I worked on or participated in, both when I was at FBI and towards the end of the prior administration through this one, along with being a National Security Division, is you had a group in the National Security Council of terrorism experts who would sit around the table in the National Security Council in the Situation Room, and we would get briefed on what the intel showed the threat is, and then we would work together to say, here's the tool I can bring to disrupt this particular terrorist. Let's say it's a particular terrorist group or a terrorist individual. Here's the potential to bring a possible criminal charge. Treasury would say, here are potential sanctions I could levy or disrupt their finances. When it comes to terrorism, the military might say, here are actions we could take because we're in an area of active conflict. State Department would talk about diplomatic. That became a well-trod, well-used mechanism. You had group like NCTC that would collate the intelligence across the community to give a coherent portrait of the threat. You're seeing now the so-called CRG or Cyber Response Group at National Security Council model itself more over this after that CSG model, where they're really looking at how can we drive operation, not direct an operation, but how can we drive change and make sure that everyone's aware of the different tools that they have at the table. As part of that, they created this new, under the auspices of the Director of National Intelligence, they have a cyber threat integration center that looks to take the inputs from all the different parts of the community, be it NSA, FBI, Department of Homeland Security, and put it into a product that says the view of the community is X actor is doing Y, or this breach was X actor, that then can drive the whole of government response on tools. And to your premise that this is going to be an issue of great significance to the next presidency. I think that's exactly right. And you've heard that from the director of national intelligence in terms of Clapper, in terms of how he assesses the severity of this threat. You've heard it from the director of the FBI as well.
So one set of tools, and I want to figure out a way to ask this without stoking interagency tension. One of the actors that has a big theoretical role to play is DHS. And as you know, there are a lot of entities in government that, when confronted by the choice of agency to help them with cybersecurity problems, and in the private sector, do not have wild confidence in DHS in doing that. And I'm interested in, you know, in the period in which this approach has evolved, to what extent, in your experience, has DHS kind of risen to the occasion and, you know, built up capacity that it didn't have previously? To what extent is there a real gap there that, when you think about all the tools, you know, some of them aren't up to snuff yet? You know, how do you evaluate the presence or absence of tools in the toolbox when you look across the agencies responsible for wielding them?
Look, I think Department of Homeland Security has come a long way in building up the so-called NCIC that serves as, although I'm not so familiar that I could actually tell you
what
that stands for, right. But National Cyber... Anyway, it shares information, it receives information from the private sector and shares information with the private sector. And they've also helped to encourage sharing within sectors so that you have company-to-company information sharing, which in cyber is so important. And so you've seen a significant dedication of resources, time, and attention to build that capacity. When it comes to each of the department and agencies involved, almost everything that you're seeing now is new in terms of the approach. And so I think for all of us, there's more to be done, and it's going to take a continued amount of attention and drive to get where we need to get.
When you look at the Department of Justice and you say, what's the tool set that's missing from us right now? What don't you have that you need in the way of law, in the way of, capability? What's not there that should be there?
Well, one thing is we're applying this dedicated approach of doing investigation and attribution in a way that it can be made public and then looking for consequences. We're still new, so I may, and we need to keep trying it. When we hit barriers, then brief out what we think they are. I mean, there are little things that need statutory change, right? It's something like either 46 or 47 states have different data breach notification laws. That means if you're a company doing business in multiple states at once and you get breached, you have to go and figure out what the laws are in the books that are administered by different states' attorney general as to what you need to disclose and to whom and what the threshold is for disclosing it. That just, other than providing business to lawyers, doesn't make any sense. We ought to have one nationwide standard for breach notification, and I hope we can get there. Another area that we talk about a little bit in the article is we need a legal mechanism so that we can take action to when there's a botnet. So a botnet is a series of compromised computers. And the way they usually operate is there's a command and control server. Hundreds of thousands sometimes of individual home computers will be compromised by the bad guy that sets up this botnet. It can be used for things like the denial of service attack against our financial sector that affected hundreds of thousands of customers and cost the companies tens of millions of dollars. It was done by Iranian affiliated actors. When we discover that botnet at times, you want to be able to issue some command to get rid of the malware on those computers, or at least to notify the victims. There's not a clear legal mechanism to do that right now. It's been done before in one case, so-called Game Over Zeus case, and in Core Flood. And you saw us also take steps to dismantle the botnet that's used by the Iranians. But we're often patching together criminal, civil authorities. Sometimes we're using the power of the pulpit. So that might be one area to see if there's a constructive either rule change or legislative change, so that if you know you have, there's some way to notify the victims of the disease, if you will, if you know that they're infected.
But right now, we've seen, when you talk about all tools, we've seen one tool very dramatically, which is prosecutions, both announced and actually, pursued. We've seen diplomatic discussions, and we've seen the threat of sanctions and sort of Treasury Department action and sort of the infrastructure put in place to do some of that, but we haven't actually seen any of it happen yet. What are the next sort of set of things that we should be looking to actually see happen, reflecting the diversity of tools that, you know, you've identified in this paper as available?
So one thing is, I think we need to routinize enforcement. In other words, right now, when we do an enforcement action, you'll often play out in the pages of Lawfare online. There'll be a lot of analysis that says, boy, they brought a case against five members of the People's Liberation Army. What does it say about our China policy? What does it mean? How are they going to react? Same if we bring the prosecution against the individual Subin. Similarly, we did the Iranian denial of service.
Right, these are
attack.
Big deal cases every time they happen.
But when they happen, they're often viewed in the lens of the relationship with the country. What does it say about our China relations? What does it say about our Iran relations? What does this mean about our Syria policy? Did Syrian Electronic Army? And as we, I think, routinize these enforcement actions, it may say less about what our bilateral relationships with any of the one country is, and more, we're in a world where there are norms in cyberspace, and when you get caught breaking them, there are consequences. So we're just going to routinely see enforcement actions, and that also means those who would like to conduct this activity need to look over their shoulder, which has a cost of its own, before they do this type of activity, because it's not consequence free anymore. So in that sense, it will mean use of the executive order that's been in place that's now in place to sanction individual, more criminal cases, more use of the commerce designation of entities. You may start seeing use of the civil system. There's a new statute that allows for the federal economic espionage cases to be brought in federal courts by private actors. It might be use of USTR's tools to bring a trade action. You're seeing some trade actions in other fora, but I think you'll start seeing an increased number of enforcement actions across the board, and it'll start to seem normal.
And dense, right? I mean, you're describing a density of action.
Yes.
And over what time frame should we, I mean, I'm not asking about any specific case, but over what time frame should we think about, should we be looking for that increased density?
Well, I think you're starting to see it increase, but say over the next 5 years. Now, you always want to be an optimist, despite having been a long-time prosecutor. If the conduct stops, great. Then you will see less action.
So somehow I don't think we need to fear that.
But otherwise, I think I hope to see it over the next, you know, three to five years. So we have these tools in place, and you start seeing the exercise. Another sign of real, I think, success in this area will be when it's not just the United States, and we start to. And I've seen and had discussions. I think there's great international interest. No one really likes living in this status quo where it's every person or every company. If you choose to venture into the internet, you do so at your own peril. And so As they now have these new norms on the book, that they start taking actions to enforce them as well.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. We are making huge progress in getting up our iTunes ratings where they should be. If you've been part of that progress, big thanks. If not, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast on iTunes. You are the only advertising we have, so please help us out. Our music, as ever, is performed by the Right Honorable Sophia Yan, who always says,
"You let someone walk across your lawn long enough, they have the right to walk across your lawn."
Thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.